At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
There is a certain deja vu all over again quality to things right now, huh? Hurricanes, Washington messing with the economy, big data breaches too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Friday, September the 8th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There is news to be had today. Irma and Equifax, to name a couple, and we will get to them in just a minute. But there is also some summing up to be done of where things stand in the American economy this week, because it has been a curious 5 days. Lee Gallagher is at Fortune Magazine. Sheila Kolhatkar is at The New Yorker. Hey, everybody.
Hi, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
Sheila, let me begin with you and this, it has to be said, curious deal that President Trump made with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic leaders in the Congress today, to push back the debt limit and the budget deadline. I'm going to use a four-letter word in Washington now, I imagine, bipartisanship. Could this be the wave of the future, I guess?
Well, I think it's possibly an indication once again that President Trump does not fully grasp some of the game playing that goes on in Washington. And this whole debt ceiling debate is a really good example. I mean, there are people who believe that we should just get rid of the debt ceiling because it doesn't have any real meaning beyond being used as this tool of protest, usually of the party that is not in power in Congress. And it seems that the Democrats very effectively employed it in that way.
Yeah,
and took
it away from Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan, right, Lee?
They did. I mean, it was shocking. But on the other hand, you know, if you think about it, we know that the president is someone who's easily aggrieved. He hasn't been. He hates Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan, and you know, his base hates the GOP leadership, and so, you know, he's the wrecking ball, and so that's sure enough that he's wrecking everything. He's coming in with, you know, being the disruptor, I guess. I also think he just walked into that room and saw Chuck Schumer and just felt a little hometown comforts of home, you know, like
New York, he just hugged him.
Yeah. So it was a crazy one, though.
Sheila, we should be clear here that we're going to go through this now again in December, right? We're going to have the debt limit discussion. We're going to have a budget continuing resolution that's going to expire. None of this actually solves anything.
No, it doesn't. And of course, the Republicans were pushing to extend this re-upping of the limit as far into the future as possible to just sort of put it even beyond midterm elections. And the Democrats wanted to just sort of push it off just a little bit so they could revisit this and possibly use it as leverage. And of course, it's important to remember that it doesn't really have any connection to spending. The debt limit just gives the U.S. permission to borrow money from other countries. If Republicans want to control spending, they should be, you know, doing that through legislation, and they should be finding ways to pay for the tax cuts that they seem to want, rather than passing huge tax cuts and then complaining about, you know, extending the debt limit.
Right. Lee, let's get to the tax reform package. The president likes to call it tax cuts, but tax reform is what congressional Republicans keep talking about. I wonder how badly this basically cramps the style of those who want to get tax reform done by the end of the year, because now by Thanksgiving, Christmas time, we're all going to be turned to the debt limit in the budget again.
That's true. And also, certainly, this begs the question, are there more bipartisan deals in the future?
Yeah.
But the tax reform is really the big thing. I mean, after healthcare, you know, this is the next big thing. And the president needs a win on this. And frankly, you know, it's also a big test for Gary Cohn, who was also in the news this week.
Well, right. So, are you looking at my notes? That's in my notes. Gary Cohn. Gary Cohn's the next item in my notes.
Perfect segue.
So, Sheila, let me throw you the question first. News this week that Gary Cohn, widely rumored to have been President Trump's choice for Fed chair when Janet Yellen's term expires in January. He is now on the outs with the president. It is reported after basically standing up to the president for his remarks after Charlottesville. The question I need to ask you, though, is this. Why does President Trump want to get rid of Janet Yellen? He said nasty things about her during the campaign, but it is tradition for presidents to reappoint Fed chairs in their first term.
Well, as Lee already mentioned, he is the wrecking ball, so he's going to keep us on our toes.
Is that but just also, the answer today? That's the answer, right? He's the wrecking ball.
We know from Janet Yellen's academic research that she has some issues she really cares passionately about: poverty, income inequality, creating jobs, and the regulation of Wall Street. Mm. And frankly, that puts her at odds with a lot of the deregulators that Trump has surrounded himself by in Washington. She made a very impassioned defense of the Dodd-Frank financial reform legislation that I thought, you know, was actually much needed at this moment when that legislation is in peril. So, although there are many people who would argue that he should keep her, I have a hard time picturing it just because she's so at odds with these people who seem to be informing a lot of his decision making.
On the other hand, he likes low interest rates, you know, because they're good for him. And he did say, you know, a month ago, I like her. I like her demeanor. You know, now he likes her demeanor.
Right.
So, you know, it's love, hate. It's flip flop. It's keeping everyone on their toes.
It's survivor.
It is.
Don't even. Sheila Kohlhaut-Garth, the New Yorker, and Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Guy.
Thank you.
Right. Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, Midland. Mostly tech did get whacked just a little bit. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We got in touch with Equifax today to see if maybe the CEO wanted to come on and explain how the personal data of 143 million American consumers, social security numbers, dates of birth, the really valuable stuff, how it got hacked. Here is the response we got from the company verbatim. Thank you for reaching out. We have no further information to contribute at this point other than what is in the news release. So we went to the press release, which quotes CEO Richard Smith as saying that the hack strikes at the heart of who we are and what we do. But if what you do, your core corporate competency, is gather and check our personal and confidential financial information, and it gets hacked instead, that's bad, right? Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
From a crisis management standpoint, you can't sugarcoat this. The massive data breach is just awful for Equifax, at least short term, says CFRA research analyst Keith Snyder.
It makes them look very bad. And, you know, to be honest, consumer credit bureaus weren't exactly popular with customers to begin with.
Stephen Hahn Griffiths at the Reputation Institute says this is a black eye for the company.
In the same way, if a fast food outlet has food poisoning issues, or if an airline has a crash, obviously it's core to their service delivery.
Though Hahn Griffiths says it's much worse for financial companies when they're caught deceiving or cheating customers. And he says consumers are actually pretty forgiving about data hacks, perhaps because the problem seems so widespread. Peter Cohen teaches business at Babson College and predicts Equifax will recover in time.
Reputationally, it's probably not quite as bad as the one that affected Chipotle in the sense that what's happening here is not making people ill.
Also, consumers often don't choose their credit agency and might not even know it's Equifax checking their financials, says David Cass at the University of Maryland.
Consumers, the way the system is set up, do not have much choice and will sort of have to rely on them in the future.
What would be really bad for Equifax, the experts say, is if the hack turns out to be worse than first reported, or if consumers have a bad experience with the services the company offers to help with identity theft. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
I posed this question on Twitter today, and I'll ask it here again to set up this next Irma story. Is it possible that this storm, worst case, could do $1 trillion worth of damage?
Of course, the answer is that we sure hope not. But insurance companies are paying close attention. And it turns out most of the damage from this storm, unlike Harvey, is going to be more of a wind thing than rain. Marketplace's Scott Tong explains.
Hurricane Harvey was a dramatic flooding event, but Irma is a much faster-moving storm, i.e. less prolonged dumping of rain.
This event seems like it's going to be much more of a wind event.
Elise Greenspan is property casualty insurance analyst at Wells Fargo. She says wind and storm damage tends to be covered by property insurance, as opposed to floods, which require separate coverage that many people don't have.
There should be less of a disparity with Irma just because more of a component of the loss will come from wind.
Estimates for Irma's damage range from $20 billion to upwards of $200 billion. And mostly that means payouts to property owners. Robert Hartwig co-directs the Center for Risk and Uncertainty Management at the University of South Carolina.
We're talking about homeowners insurance on condominiums, apartments, and other forms of dwellings. And in addition, business property. So that would include commercial structures, your shopping malls, banks, retail outlets.
Losses are not just a function of a storm's size, but also how much property is in the way. And Florida has been criticized for allowing too much coastal building. Indeed, insurance prices have not always reflected the true risk, says Jack Nicholson. He directs Florida's Catastrophic Storm Risk Management Center.
The insurance was way underpriced for a number of years, and that was kind of the state holding their rates down intentionally to make insurance cheaper.
In the last couple of years, he says, Florida's insurance market has reformed, so there's less incentive to overbuild in harm's way. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
According to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, corporate relief donations since Harvey hit now come to about $165 million. They have provided, those companies have, logistical support and supplies to government and nonprofits in Houston and Louisiana as well. And with Irma on its way to Florida, public-private disaster partnerships are happening again. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has that one.
In a briefing today, Florida Governor Rick Scott name-dropped several big companies that are helping prepare for Hurricane Irma.
We are coordinating with Google Emergency Response Team to prepare to close roads on Google Maps in real time in the event Hurricane Irma forces the closure of any roads.
He went on to mention Expedia providing real-time information on hotel occupancy and Airbnb's disaster response program. James Lee Witt knows these public-private collaborations well. He directed the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, under President Bill Clinton. Witt recalls partnering with a corporation way back in 1993 when the Mississippi River flooded.
We needed water, and I called Anheuser-Busch. Anheuser-Busch made thousands of cases of canned water for us.
These days, companies like Walmart watch storm forecasts carefully to try to plan for disasters in advance. Walmart was able to tap its extensive distribution network to rush in supplies like ready-to-eat foods, water, and diapers to help Hurricane Harvey victims.
We were shipping in product from as far away as Utah.
Lee Seiler is responsible for global disaster preparedness and response at the Walmart Foundation. He says Walmart's partnership with government and nonprofits involves offering them expertise in logistics and warehousing so they can also deploy resources quickly.
We're increasing their capability, not just for that event, but for future events to come.
He says Walmart has a relationship with the State Emergency Center in Florida and is ready to help there, too. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's almost like I wish, you know, I could wait a few years and look back and then, oh, okay, here's what I can kind of think with a little bit of perspective.
Yeah, don't we all, pal? Don't we all? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up less than a 10% today, 13 points, 21,797 on the blue chips. NASDAQ down about a 0.5%, 37 points, 6360. S&P 500 shed about a 10%, 3 points, ended at 2461. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow left behind 0.8%. NASDAQ decelerated 1.1%, S&P 500 off 0.6%. You think you're not happy about Equifax? Shareholders neither. The company shares ended the day down 13.6%. Credit monitoring agency TransUnion down 3.8%. Fair Isaac Corporation FICO down 0.7%. Today, bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note notched up to 2.05%.
You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look, payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Rima Kreis took us out to cattle country yesterday. Schuyler, Nebraska, population 6,106, for a story about immigrant labor and how that workforce has become a critical link in the American food supply chain. Schuyler's got a huge Cargill beef packing plant, a growing immigrant population as well. And Rima tells us in story number two today that those new arrivals are changing the town's economy, but it's not necessarily the growth strategy everybody is looking for.
The first day of school has just ended, and kids are trickling into the ice cream shop in downtown Schuyler. It's been a tough day. Over in the corner, there's a competition going on to see who can down their ice cream the fastest without getting a brain freeze.
One, two, three.
Norma Corral, the woman ticking off the ice cream flavors, owns Pelletria Oasis. She and her husband moved from Mexico to this small rural town outside of Omaha in the early 90s. They both worked at Cargill's giant beef processing plant. But after 10 years of slicing carcasses in near freezing temperatures, Corral quit.
Me salí porque me empezó a doler mucho el hombro.
I left because my shoulder began hurting a lot. Being there for 8 hours making the same movements and your bones and the cold, it hurts.
With money she'd saved from her plant job and a bank loan, Corral opened the ice cream shop. In 15 years, she's expanded and business has doubled. Walk into almost any store in downtown Schuyler and you're likely to hear some version of this same story of former plant workers turned entrepreneurs.
The neighbors here at the 99 cent store, they used to work at the plant and now have their business. The shop next to El Paisano, too. He works at the plant and the wife runs the business. So there is lots of us.
In many small towns, Latino-owned businesses, if they exist, are clustered together away from the main shops. But in Schuyler, which is 65% Latino, they are the main shops.
We get some really good smells from the food places down here, the restaurants.
David Renicki is mayor of Schuyler with its 6,000 residents and one traffic light. But politics is a part-time gig. He also owns a Ford dealership.
You don't want to buy a Mustang while you're here, do you? 520-some horsepower.
Are you trying to sell me a car right now?
No, I just thought I'd mention it.
Tempting. Renicki says Schuyler was predominantly white until the late 80s when the local meat processing plant rolled back its wages.
A lot of the white people didn't want to work that job anymore because they weren't making as much money. And through the course of maybe the next 20 years, Cargill had to get some people here to work the jobs.
By around 2004, Latinos were doing most of those jobs, and many white residents had left Schuyler. But a steady influx of immigrants has more than made up the difference.
Unlike a lot of small rural communities that are losing population, we're going to be here 50 years from now.
And along with the population, the politics are shifting too.
Last year, I was elected as a school board member. I think it was the first Latino elected for any public office, period, in Schuyler.
That's Minor Hernandez. He's picking up his 9-year-old son from school.
Hola, mijo.
Hola.
Alejandro goes straight for the goldfish. Hernandez says Schuyler schools are filling up fast.
They are adding 5 classrooms and a musical room to the high school right now just because we know that growth is coming. So we're trying to stay ahead of those challenges.
30 miles down the road in the much larger town of Fremont, residents have been trying to stay ahead of those challenges in a very different way. They've been trying to stop the development of a huge chicken processing plant.
So here's where the plant is going to be.
51-year-old John Wiegert grew up in Fremont.
And my folks live over by the high school, and my brother lives just down the street from them. So
the $300 million chicken processing plant is being built by Costco and will create 800 jobs.
We're worried about the air quality, influx of possible illegals coming in.
Fremont is more than 80% white. In 2010, voters approved a referendum barring landlords from renting to undocumented immigrants. Bob Warner, a former city councilman, led that effort. He says he doesn't want Fremont to become another Schuyler.
That was a farming community until that packing house went in there, and it is absolutely ashamed of what it is today. The downtown no longer is what it used to be, a Nebraska town.
Wiegert, who's sitting next to Warner, chimes in.
We are very welcoming of immigrants, but we just want them to assimilate into our culture. You know, speak our language, be legal.
Even though many residents are still fighting the Costco plant, city officials are behind it. Randy Thaland is vice president of economic development for the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce. He says some local residents may fear change.
But the other side of that coin is, what's the future without growth? What's a future without new economic activity?
He says the plant will create a larger tax base, more homes, and new business owners who just might get their start at the processing plant. In Fremont, Nebraska, I'm Rima Crace for Marketplace.
This is a big weekend for fans of the historical time traveler genre. Outlander Season 3 starts Sunday. Ronald D. Moore is the guy in charge. Outlander is his latest stint showrunning, as it's called, in a career that started with Star Trek The Next Generation and also the reboot of Battlestar Galactica. He has made his bones, you could say, in science fiction. Thanks for coming to the studio.
Thank you. I'm going to read you a quote, and it's you actually talking about what you do and how you do it.
Okay.
And then I want to get your reaction. You said, if you put these things in a science fiction context, you get a free pass, not just from networks, but from audiences as well, because you're allowing them to think about things in a way that doesn't threaten anybody, which makes sense, but explain it a little bit.
I think I was talking there about Battlestar Galactica in particular, mm-hmm. and probably Star Trek and other science fiction pieces. Essentially, you know, one of the great advantages of working in science fiction is it does give you an opportunity to talk about interesting and somewhat controversial, you know, themes and social issues and in a way that doesn't really threaten the audience because I'm not challenging their particular points of view.
You're a Star Trek guy from way back, like the original series.
I grew up with it, yeah.
Yeah. Even back then, you thought there were lessons in here?
I did. I think it was one of the things, you know, I started watching Trek in the mid-70s when I was in, you know, elementary school, and I was just into space. Somewhere along the way, I started realizing there were really interesting ideas in this show.
How did you get to Battlestar Galactica then? I mean, not to fast forward too far.
I got a call from an executive at Universal And I said, give me the weekend to think about it. And I went out and tracked down a VHS copy of the original.
Oh, the original? Wow, yeah.
At Blockbuster. Ask your parents. Got the tape, watched it over that weekend, and this was like January, February of 2002.
Yeah.
So it was just a few months after the 9/11 attacks. And when I watched the original Battlestar pilot at that moment in time, I realized almost immediately that if you did this show now, at that time and place, right, it would have a completely different resonance. And I thought, this is an enormous opportunity to do something relevant, to do something that's commenting about our society and the times that we were living with, and to get science fiction back to what I thought the original Star Trek did, which was to talk about society and to talk about, you know, the things we were going through in a science fiction way, to and view it through that lens. So I called him back on Monday and said, yeah, let's do it.
You do Battlestar Galactica. You have great success. You win a Peabody. I mean, it does really, really well. And it is still to this day a cultural thing. How do you go from there to Outlander, which, while interesting and creative, is not quite science fiction, and it's also sort of got a different lens on it?
It was interesting now looking back on it, because I never had the experience of reading the book as a book to just sit and enjoy it. I read it as a piece of material, like, can I adapt this right off the bat?
That sounds so clinical.
Which is very different. Yeah. It's a bit more clinical. I like the attention to detail that Diana Gabaldon had done.
She's the author of the book.
Of the book. And as I was reading, I could just kind of like lay out the chapters and the episodes in my head. And by the time I finished the book, I thought, yeah, I can see this is a season of television. And so I was kind of sold and said, all right, well, let's look into the rights and let's move forward.
As you think about these times we're in, much as you thought about September 11th, mm-hmm, when you were thinking about Battlestar Galactica, where do your thoughts go in terms of creative material for you?
It's such a time of turmoil culturally and politically. You know, it's hard to sort of grapple onto one particular direction. It's almost like I wish, you know, I could wait a few years and look back and then, oh, okay, here's what I can kind of think with a little bit of perspective. I mean, all I know right now as I think about future projects is that there's a dynamic, you know, collision of many forces, and that there's a tribalism I keep seeing. You know, that's the one theme that it feels like has been resonant since, I don't know, the last 15, 20 years, is the increasing tribalism of points of view, you know, and then that, where does that lead us as a culture? And that's like an interesting territory to go in and talk about.
Ronald D. Moore, the show is Outlander. Thanks very much.
Absolutely.
This final note on the way out today, putting your money where your mouth is, division. You got your MAGA, Make America Great Again, the organizing principle of the Trump presidency, as we all know. You got your MAGAnomics, the economic foundation of said presidency, which we have told you about. Now, MAGA, the investment opportunity. Point Bridge Capital out of Fort Worth, Texas, is starting the MAGA Exchange Traded Fund. ETFs are sort of like mutual funds that trade like stocks, kind of. Anyway, the MAGA fund is going to invest in companies in the S&P 500 whose employees or political action committees have given significant amounts of money to Republican candidates. The ticker symbol? Anybody? Come on, it's almost too easy, right? MAGA. Also, consult your own investment professional, people. All right, quitting time on a Friday doesn't get any better than that, does it? The Dow up less than a 10% today, 13 points. NASDAQ down about a 0.5%, 37 points. S&P 500 down a 10th, 3 points on that particular exchange. Our index, I suppose. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you Monday, everybody. Have yourself a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.